Welcome back, everyone. I'm Bennett Tomlin, and I'm joined, as usual, by my partner in crime, Mr. Cass Piancy. Cass, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. We have a little background noise, but other than that, I'm good. How about you, Bennett? How are you?
Well, I'm doing pretty well. Today, we're joined by a very special guest, Dr. Micah Warren, a professor of mathematics at the University of Oregon, and the author of the recent textbook, Bitcoin, A Game Theoretic Analysis. How are you doing today, Micah?
Doing all right.
We brought you on here today to talk a little bit about what makes Bitcoin secure and what makes Bitcoin not secure. So let's start with the first half of that. What helps keep Bitcoin secure?
Well, I guess if you're going to answer that question, you have to ask what is attacking Bitcoin. It used to be that I think people thought the biggest threat vector was people doing double spins. And this was like in the early days when you could mine a few blocks on your laptop. It was very possible that you could go, sell somebody some bike parts on Craigslist and then go home and then line up all your laptops and maybe try to do a double spin or something and get the $50 back somehow. But those days are long over, and now it's very hard to do a double spin. So I think the major thing that Bitcoin has to worry about is miners colluding or, somehow acquiring lots of hash rate and just taking over the whole network and then basically owning the network.
So less perhaps about like directly trying to profit from a double spin and more about trying to either like take on a censorious position in the network or gain some other type of advantageous position in the network. In that vein, what do you think is the least appreciated weakness by most Bitcoin advocates? Like, what do you think is most commonly missed when they're thinking through like Bitcoin security and how it works?
So I think they believe that it's impossible, that it's impossible to 51% attack the network because it's impossible because 51% is too much. But the thing about 51% is it's less than 100%. So, the entirety of the hash rate of all the hash rate is 100%. 51% is is a subset of that. Like, all you need is those miners to agree. And most people believe this will not happen. But over time, I think the security considerations are going to change. And it will be more advantageous for miners who are really just fighting over scraps to start to make collusive agreements to kind of like form sort of soft trusts and start to work towards more of a collusive monopolistic type of security model.
And when you say the incentives are going to change, what we're mostly talking about is like the halvenings, right? Is that every 4 years, the amount of new Bitcoins available to the miners goes down. And because of that, the incentives start to change around that, right?
This is one of the most obvious ones. But there's also going to be other factors, like the fact that it's not a new thing and the miners aren't like kind of like early adopters that are trying to boost the technology. Like if you go out 20 years from now, Bitcoin, if it's around, will just be another thing like email. And you won't have people like, basing their lives like around with a personality, that they're excited about email or something. And if it's just another way to make money, and if your business comes or goes, I think less of a, I still think we're kind of in the early stages where people are trying to get this to get to a point where it's got mass adoption and it's credible and it's viable. And if it ever crosses that point, where you're no longer trying to make this case to the public that it does work, then the miners can kind of look at each other and start going after each other's profits and things like that.
Haven't the miners already done a meeting like in the past where they like had to discuss how, I don't remember if it was a mining pool or if it was miners themselves, where they had to like discuss that they were controlling too much of the hash rate and like to tamp it down? I thought that happened already. Imagining that?
There was one event. I don't know if it's the same one. There was a mining pool back in like 2014, Ghash, where they had claimed over 55% of the blocks or something like that. And then everybody kind of freaked out and left the pool. But this is a pool, so it's not the same thing. And of course, that was 2014, I think, which was like Bitcoin was 5 years old. And like it was still very much a small hobbyist thing. And so people would look at that negatively back then. It wasn't, you didn't have Michael Saylor holding like billions of dollars of his public company's stock in this thing. So I think the set of incentives were a little bit different back then. So I guess I'm saying, I don't think they would necessarily run away. They would see this as this horrible nightmare, as they did when it was understood, you know, 10 years ago, the Bitcoin was kind of an experiment. I think once people no longer think of it as an experiment, they think of it as a functioning thing. They're more likely to kind of go after the little, you know, bits of profit here and there that they can in a way they might not have done 10 years ago.
One thing that I think you've actually changed my mind on more recently relates to like the market fragility hypothesis and like conceptual failures of Bitcoin. Can you talk a little bit about what those mean in this context?
Yeah. So probably the main security assumption that most people make is that miners will never collude to attack the network because that would be the end of Bitcoin. Like, and this is definitely like, it was true 10 years ago. If all the miners would have said, okay, we are just taking over the network, monopolizing it, it would have been a matter of months before it was history, right? Like nobody would have put up with that. But over the last 10 years, we've had all these people stepping up and selling this as like a long-term store of value. It's a hedge against inflation. It's this useful way to, cut out the credit card company's fees using Lightning. It's a useful way to send money overseas. It's a way to you know, that dissidents, you know, fighting dictators in foreign countries can, like, you know, collect money, can move it around, and you know, all this, these great properties. A lot of these properties don't 100% require a non-monopoly miner, right? It's like if there were four companies that were sort of like kind of like colluding to mine and kind of, you know, had some sort of trust arrangement where they were keeping the hash rates low or something, you know, you could still send money to somebody in some other country. You could still do all these things. You could still store your value and watch the number go up and then sell everything. So I don't think it's the same situation where if a corporation decided to move in and took sort of a heavier and heavier portion of the hash rate, started selfish mining, started forming some agreements with other mining corporations, I don't think everyone would run for the exits. So that's what I call the market fragility hypothesis, and it's what people used to believe, but I don't think it's true.
What's the incentive that these miners would have to collude at that point? Like, what are they doing that is making this a profitable venture for them?
Well, so in theory, mining is a very competitive industry, right? It's supposedly like somewhat like a perfectly competitive. I mean, and all the hash, you know, the hash is basically fungible, and you're just, you know, everybody's fighting for the small margins. So if you're spending, say globally, if the spend to try to get Bitcoin by miners is $10 billion in a year, they might be getting like $11 billion in return. And so these are sort of, it might be much less. They're getting some very small profit margins. But if you can collude, if 51% of you decide to do this, you can spend $5.3 billion and you can get that same $11 billion in revenue. So your profit margin is just like jumped by an order of magnitude or two. So, and it goes beyond that. Like once you have a monopoly, like once you can actually do other things like differential pricing. You can insist that if someone's going to send $1 million transaction, they include a $200 fee or something like that. And you can kind of make your own rules where you couldn't do that in the way it's much more favorable to the transactors in the current landscape.
So if they're able to do this and collude to compromise it in these ways that make it much more profitable for them, what's to keep people using it at that point? Like, why would people want to stick around on the Bitcoin blockchain?
So this is something which, I mean, you think about, why do people use Twitter? Why do people use Facebook? Why do people use Google? Why do people use a lot of things? Why do people use Grubhub? I recently heard this term that Cory Doctorow came up with called enshittification. And it's this process that happens to almost everything on the internet, where it starts out as kind of a useful thing. You know, it's useful like Facebook, like, you know, when, you know, 15 years ago, it was kind of nice. You just kept up with your friends, kept up, you know, met up occasionally with people in other states that you realize were like one town over, that kind of thing. And like, it was kind of cool. I liked Facebook 15 years ago. Then a decade later, it's like I'm arguing with, I don't know, some guy I didn't go to high school with about gun control or something, and watching my family members go down like QAnon rabbit holes, and it's become like a really shitty place. And you look at what happens to lots of network internet phenomenon, like Uber was actually kind of convenient and cheaper like 10 years ago. Recently it's actually not. Like, I recently have used cabs and found that like they're actually much more cheaper and convenient than Ubers. There's a lot of things where the whole model of a lot of the internet business over the last 10, 15 years is to like capture some sort of network effect, make sure that everybody's using the network. They don't really have any viable alternatives which fill that role, and then just let it kind of deteriorate to the point where they're capturing all the surplus.
So don't you think though, and you know, maybe you'll tell me I'm absolutely wrong here, but like, don't you think that the stickiness of these networks is maybe not as sticky as Uber and Lyft? Like, Uber and Lyft were able to, in a sense, monopolize the taxi cab customer base, and taxi cabs kind of disintegrated, that industry disintegrated, and now people don't even think about using cabs as an alternative anymore. I'm curious what would keep people on the Bitcoin network. Like, why would they be sticky? Why would they want to stay on the Bitcoin network if it felt like it was compromised, if there was clear like collusion between miners or something along those lines?
Well, this is the, you know, there can be only one, like, you know, that's what the Michael Saylors are trying to create is this, there is one store of value. It is Bitcoin. You're either off it or you're on it. And if you're, you know, you're not long it, you're short it. It's like, we all have to agree that this is a store of value. And if we all agree to that, then, or, you know, if, where do we go if someone decides to defect? Like, you just sell it and then go home? Or we can just agree that it's still working. Like, the number is still going up. The number, you know, all these things are still happening. Like, it's a slow process where like, you know, you're sort of rationalizing this over time. You're like, okay, this is slightly, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, Facebook or whatever, at some point you eventually dump it, but like a lot of people, it takes them 5 or 10 years, or Twitter, you use it, you keep using Twitter, even though like it's run by someone who's like actively in shitifying it, like speed running this whole thing. But you know that like at some point it might not be there, but you're still using it because you get more engagement. You know, I tried using Mastodon and kind of crept back over to Twitter a little bit because like I just, there's just not the same level of engagement. And so it's a network, people use it. That's inertia is going to last for a while. It might last 5 years. It might last 10 years. So this could be the same thing with Bitcoin. You go in, and if you got 10 years of like decent profits before the whole thing collapses, you don't care. That's pretty good. That's better than eking out these tiny profits, you know, fighting very competitively with all the other miners.
And like, Cass, I think it's possible that like when you and I think about Bitcoin, the first thing we think about and the thing we most relate to with Bitcoin is its value as this censorship-resistant medium of value transfer, right? You can send transactions that no one else can stop. A lot of the Bitcoin ethos at this point is oriented around like number go up, store of value, all of these things that may be tangentially related to censorship resistant, but are somewhat distinct. And so you wonder if some of those people might be willing to tolerate some loss of censorship resistance. And this really kind of came into focus for me. Mike and I recently did a panel together with the publisher of his textbook to talk about some of these types of things. And one of the other panelists mentioned that they'd heard from a staff member of a politician who was asking, what would it take to get miners to agree to like the most simple of censorious requests? Like, let's say you never again do a transaction to any of the OFAC addresses. Let's start with that. And like, the idea, I think, is that this type of takeover, this type of conceptual failure would happen kind of slowly and in the smallest reasonable step each time. Oh no, we're just no longer going to let you transact with OFAC addresses, but anyone else in the world, you can still send your Bitcoin to. okay, now it's OFAC addresses plus this list of addresses that are known to be related to child sexual abuse material, right? And eventually you keep pushing that until, well, if we only have this many minors, does it really matter if we start, like, cranking up the block size and making it unfeasible for, like, a home user to verify the blockchain? And gradually, eventually, you get to the point where portions of the community have stripped off along the way, but there was never, like, a single schism event, and so there was never, like, a true viable alternative until Bitcoin is captured.
So I've heard 10 years, 5 years, so some sort of metric where there's, like, a sustainable amount of time that there's still volume, there's still users, there's still trading going on Bitcoin. But I'm just curious, like, we already have a lot of competitor chains in essence, right? Like, I think Monero has taken over. When Bennett and I think about, like, oh, censorship-resistant, like, privacy money that isn't nation-state built, like, I think most people think about Monero more, who are, like, super into that stuff. I think there's other chains that are more used for transactability. Probably one I would hate to admit is, like, I think people use Tron because it's cheap and fast. I think there's actual movement, and Solana and stuff like that. So I think they are already capturing some of these people who were previously using Bitcoin. Are we already seeing this happen then in real time, like without nation states or miners needing to do anything at all?
Well, I guess a good question is, like, what percentage, you know, you have this huge market cap, you know, half a trillion dollars supposedly in Bitcoin. How many of this comes from these people that would leave and immediately go to Monero, and how much of this is, you know, these people that just want number go up and they don't really care? If this is a significant portion, then, you know, shedding a few of these people over to Monero over time, or the people that just need a quick means of transaction overseas, that's not going to have a significant impact. And it might not be something that, like, a possible minor collusion group would be afraid of.
Well, and what's interesting to me is there's even kind of an argument that at a certain point, if number go up, if the value of your investment is your primary driving thing, censorship resistance could actually work against that, right? If your coin token investment starts getting the reputation as being the funding mechanism of choice for all these societally undesirable things, the value of your investment is likely to suffer. And so there's kind of these points of divergence where potentially these competing interests of these different people who all consider themselves Bitcoiners threaten kind of like where sticking strictly to one threatens the interests of this other group.
Yeah, I mean, if there's a strong collusion, that could actually kill two birds with one stone, and that they could actually drop the hash rate, like, significantly, and that could, you don't have to worry about these, you know, billions of dollars spent on electricity if you have three or four corporations who are controlling the hash rate. That's now no longer a concern. These corporations are also protecting us from the really bad people, at the same time, and then the rest of the, you know, the rest of everybody could just put their money in there and watch the number go up, which might be appealing to enough people that you don't have to worry about this whole thing collapsing.
Yeah, and so I just, having thought more about those types of conceptual failures over the last several weeks as we were working through some of that, I have found it an increasingly kind of compelling and interesting vision of Bitcoin failure, as opposed to just the more direct, hey, look, this miner could make more money by double spending this one transaction. One other thing you recently wrote was a treatise, an essay, a piece where you decided to respond to some arguments about whether or not Bitcoin ends wars. So what do you think? Does Bitcoin end war?
Yeah, I'm pretty skeptical about that. I don't exactly know the mechanism by which it would. So it's hard to formulate a good response to that.
But that is a thing that has been argued by certain Bitcoiners, is that as hyper-Bitcoinization occurs, it eliminates or severely reduces the amount of hot wars that would occur in the world.
Right.
Popular argument.
I mean, this is, there's a real argument there. Like Alex Gladstein's made this argument that just the ability to print money and spend it means that you're always going to be spending it on things like the military. And this can be bad. And so I guess there's a reasonable argument there. I don't know that, I mean, that's an argument for why fiat and wars go together. But it doesn't mean that like removing or adding Bitcoin to the situation will completely remove the ability of the government to somehow incentivize people to create weapons that they can use to attack their adversaries with. Like there's other ways besides lending, which governments can, or borrowing that governments can use to create weapons.
And there's some versions of the argument where Bitcoin almost becomes like the battleground where these nation states will fight. What do you think of those arguments?
You would never want to go into a battle where you know that you are going to lose. It's like, I'm going to play, you know, the game where you pull out, what's it called, Big Wallet or something, or Big Bank, where you open up your wallet and whoever's got has the most money in the wallet gets to keep everybody's wallet. I don't know if anyone's actually played this game, but you know, people have challenged me to it. I'm like, no. Like, if somebody walks into a party and they're like, hey, let's open up our wallets and whoever has the most money gets to keep everybody else's money. Like, why would you do that? Why would you agree to that game? You know, take you know the $58 in your wallet so you can get home, rather than, you know. So there's no reason that anyone would ever put themselves in a position where they would be vulnerable to someone who is going to outspend them in some sort of an auction situation. Like, this just doesn't. It's complete nonsense. No one would go for this, and so they would just opt out of this whole game entirely. I think that's the short.
I feel like one of the Tether executives has suggested that the first country that decides to just start buying up Bitcoin, with whatever their currency is, like just print your currency and keep buying Bitcoin. Maybe it was Samson Mao, and just like that would be the country that wins in the end. And I was just like, this is so absurd. And it also just flies in the face of the suggestion that it can end all wars or anything like that. It's like, oh, well, on one hand, they're suggesting you just print money and just keep buying Bitcoin. And then on the other, they're suggesting that it's going to end all wars and it's going to stop spending. And it's going to like, it sounds like, no, it's going to keep spending going just in only one direction.
Yeah, I mean, people are kind of having their own competition for the most bullish hypothesis. And so, you know, scenarios in which like nation states are FOMOing into Bitcoin is kind of like the top level of that. So I think that's the goal there.
I mean, we're seeing it on some small level, at least, right? We're seeing it with El Salvador. And I just looked it up. I hadn't checked on this in a while, but Central African Republic,
they abandoned it.
Yeah, they gave it up, which I'm curious why they decided to give up on that.
Well, they were very, I mean, these are very low countries on the international totem pole. So they have a little bit more, I guess, less to lose. So if they put in a little bit of their wealth and everything goes up, it looks good for them. It's an asymmetric risk that if you just have a little bit to put in, it's not, you know, it's not a completely horrible, stupid move. Central African Republic, they're part of this, you know, French system. I forget how it works, but it's kind of, it's not great for them. And it seems like they were pressured. I don't know. I'm hearing this from probably the Bitcoiners, but like they were pressured through economic means to like rethink their movement towards Bitcoin.
Interesting.
That's what we saw with El Salvador as well. Like there was the attempt by kind of the IMF and everyone else to use their access to loans and funding to convince them this experiment with Bitcoin was not worthwhile.
And this is something Bitcoin doesn't fix. This is something which I realized I came into this, you know, like I first heard about it in 2011, and I was kind of hopeful about it. I thought maybe, you know, there was some way that people organizing around a shelling point, somehow we could, you know, maybe come up with systems that would kind of claw back some of the power from corporations. And after, you know, kind of wrestling with this for a while, I realized like it's really hard to usurp, you know, power. If you don't have the power to do it, you can't do it. So they can always just use other economic incentives to beat you. And so it's a really narrow, roundabout, long path by which this could actually lead to something. And I'm, you know, something I guess sustainable and that actually accomplishes what people wanted it to do, which is kind of like take some of the power back. And I think if it ever gets to there, it's still right for someone to come and take over the whole thing.
We had Rob Green on a long time ago who did some marketing for cryptocurrency companies back in the day. And he said he also, I won't forget it just because he was the first person I heard say something like this, but it was like that he was kind of on board with some of the messaging of cryptocurrencies in general. And then the more he thought about it and the more he considered the enemies that, like, the people that Bitcoin was supposed to be going up against, which aren't just, it's not just nation states, right? Like you said, it's corporations, it's banks, it's like, it's the entire financial system. And when you think about the trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars of resources available to all of that, and all of the people employed by that industry, and like, yeah, just what you're up against, unless you have a really good plan, it's pretty much insurmountable.
Right. Yes, I remember that was a good one. The last 10 minutes, I think he went on a very nice rant, which explained this very clearly, if I remember that correctly.
It's a point you make, I think, in Limp War as well, when you compare the security spend on Bitcoin to various, like, to the amounts currently spent on defense and things like that. And I think you raised a similar point in our panel when someone talked about, like, Bitcoin's role in the energy industry. And again, you're looking at an industry where, like, the total spend is so many orders of magnitude more than Bitcoin. You can just kind of embroiling Bitcoin in those types of things makes your protocol subservient to those interests. It doesn't necessarily strengthen your protocol.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's just like it can be picked up by some multi-trillion dollar corporation. It's just sort of some wing of it. And it's, you know, part of any of their interest. Like they can drop the whole mining wing if it's not profitable, or they can sell it off, sell it to the Saudis or whatever. Like, it, you know, you can just, it's nothing compared to hundreds of trillions of dollars in other energy budgets.
One thing that sometimes kind of surprises me when I'm trying to talk about these things, like some of these potential risks to Bitcoin, which I find interesting, mostly academically, theoretically. I don't own any Bitcoin. It doesn't, in much of a meaningful sense to me, matter if Bitcoin gets attacked or not. But I just find these questions interesting. But when I talk to Bitcoiners about some of these issues, and especially when I start to get close to certain touch points, they tend to recoil. Like, if I were to, whenever I bring up that I think it is likely at some point there will be a version of Bitcoin with more than 21 million coins, and I think that there's a good chance that that one retains the ticker and a lot of the mass, there's a tendency to kind of ignore it, and not just ignore it, but kind of deny the things that would lead to that state, like deny the need for growing transaction fees, for that type of demand for block space, for the types of things that are kind of inherent in their protocol. What do you think kind of leads to that tendency in the Bitcoin community?
Well, I think there's a belief that we just need to get past, like, the next stage, the next level. We need to push through this, that we're always just like one cycle away from this, like, mass adoption. There's one cycle away from whatever the price target is that we need to, like, have everybody believe that this is real and make all the skeptics cry. And we're just almost there, and we just need to ignore this stuff, because once we can push through, once we get to that level, then we can solve all these problems. And sort of thinking about this problem before we get there is just going to stop us from getting there. We're never going to make it if we're running around when Bitcoin's $30,000 worrying about, like, the security budget in 10 years. You know, that's not going to help us. It's not going to serve the mission. So, I mean, that's what I think makes people not want to think about it, is it's, you know, there's a positive probability that this is actually bad for the long-term security of Bitcoin. So, and there aren't really good answers.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely true. But, like, for me specifically, watching some of the mainstream Bitcoiners' reactions to ordinals recently was really fascinating to me, because you saw a bunch of individuals who had advocated for turning on SegWit, who had advocated for turning on Taproot, who suddenly saw these parts of their protocol used and, in a sense, driving demand and raising transaction fees and showing, like, more demand for block space than there had been since, like, 2017, I think. And yet they were horrified that that was a thing that was occurring. And in a sense, that supports the aims of their protocols. That's aligned with all these things they claim to be in support of. But once it actually started happening, they were against it. Do you think there's do you think there's a mistaken belief that a lot of Bitcoiners hold that leads to that?
So I don't know exactly about, I mean, Taproot was kind of funny. I didn't hear anybody opposing Taproot. Like, I don't know. Like, everyone was just like, yeah, it's great. I mean, I didn't look into it too much, but I mean, it seemed like the way people were describing it, it's like, oh, you know, you could do more smart contract things. I'm like, okay, is that really what we want? Okay, but everybody loves it. But, you know, as far as this like ordinals thing, I think a lot of people think it's okay. It's Bitcoin, you know, it's supposed to operate as this fee market. It's a fee market. You know, there's supposed to be a competitive market to get, you know, get your transactions on the train on the chain, and over time we need the fees, so this is kind of good. But there's always this tension between fees and the other alternatives, and this is an interesting point, because if we want the fees to go up to replace, and they gotta go up by orders of magnitude to replace the lost fees from the block subsidy, then you're gonna have to get into the situation where people might start to leave if they're using it for all these other reasons, like you know, cross-border payments or something. If you can just easily do this with Tron, you might as well just do this with Tron, right? If it's going to cost you $200 to send this, or $2,000, like they say it's going to happen in, you know, 10, 20 years in the future, of course you're going to use Solana or Tron or Cardano or Tether or whatever, or US CBDC. Why not? If you want them to think that you're buying, a snowboard off Amazon, and you don't care that anybody knows that, like, you might as well do that in a US CBDC.
And like, what's really kind of interesting to me about this here is I think this connects right back to kind of what we were discussing with conceptual failures before and ways Bitcoin can kind of be taken over, in that like the need to replace the new issuance with these transaction fees is directly related to some of the hard money aspects that the store of value fans of Bitcoin propagate, and is like a central portion of their thesis for why Bitcoin will succeed. But like, as we're talking about here, the closer we get to that point, the larger and larger portion of the population you price out of trustlessly and censorship resistant transactions using that protocol. Like, if you're going to insist on transaction fees need to rise to this point to ensure security, you are basically admitting in that many people will never be able to use the protocol for censorship resistance. And so I think what it gets down to is kind of the tension there, is Bitcoin has been promoted as a way to bank the unbanked and provide everyone worldwide with this new way to send value in this censorship-resistant way. But the current design decisions of the protocol, including some that are seen as sacrosanct, fundamentally make that more challenging to achieve. And like, I think that, at least in part, could contribute to an eventual like kind of conceptual schism where Bitcoin would be vulnerable to the kind of like takeover you were discussing.
Right. And then, I mean, if you have to ask what happens if the fees go up, let's just say that, you know, 10 years from now, people are paying on average $250 a fee, or, you know, say times 1,000 or 2,000 a block. So, you know, you're getting this $200,000 in fees for a block or something like that. This means that there has not been a viable alternative for most people. Like nothing, like there's no reason people would kind of continually over time continue to pay these high fees for something, unless that really was like really the top dog. It really was the only one. Everything else was garbage.
Isn't this the classic container ships argument from Nick Carter?
It's related to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, yeah. Yeah, it could be that like this is the major thing that, I mean, you need to get your Lightning channel set up in this in the chain, so you're willing to pay $500 to set up your Lightning channel so you can service everybody. That is this real. There's a real built-in network effect there that you know could lead to this situation. And at this point, if this is the main container ship, then all you have to do is buy the container ship shipping company or whatever, and now you own everybody, which is I guess precisely the argument I'm trying to make, is like if everybody's shipping their stuff through one ship and you buy the ship, they don't have any other options. They've already they've already, you know, abandoned all their other little ships that they used to carry stuff with. So you're just, they're just stuck with whatever shipping company owns the ship.
Well, and just, I think Bitcoiners love to portray Bitcoin as anti-fragile, which means something that when it's stressed, it becomes stronger. But I think in many kind of respects, like we're talking about here, some of the feedback loops inherent here fight against that. Like if you assume the security budget needs to stay roughly the same or increase and you need fees to go to this certain level, then you're going to, like, as you're trying to get to that point, continually be pushing regular transactors on the network to look for alternatives and to consider alternatives. Like it fights its own like path to that point.
Right. Yeah. There are points where it is kind of anti-fragile, where you know, kind of on a local level, like you think about a ball, which is in a valley on the top of a mountain, right? Like, you know,
yeah, exactly.
You go back and forth a little bit, it's going to roll down to that little valley. But if you push it too far, the whole thing is going to, the ball's going to roll its way down to the sea.
It's a metastable state.
Isn't the argument against this, like the classic argument against any of this, that it's been around for a long time now and this hasn't happened? That nobody is trying to do this seemingly what could be like a pretty profitable move? Like, nobody is doing it. It clearly is able to protect itself against that.
And this is sort of a paradox, because once you say, like, once everybody believes this, that we've got to this point, I still think people believe we're like a, not quite there. Like, it's still the next cycle before we get to that point where it's actually, you know, set in stone and no one can mess with it. So it's a little bit paradoxical in that if once we believe this, then someone, that's what makes it vulnerable. Mm. Yeah, a lot of people still think that we have another order of magnitude or two to grow before the bullish sentiments will not be as strong. But of course, then they say once we get to $1 million, then that's when everybody knows it's secure, which is, of course, you know, there is no point like at which we know it's secure. I think it's best when it's just kind of, you're not using it to store value.
Why do you think it hasn't been attacked in any meaningful way up until this point?
Well, I think a lot of the miners are they're bullish, and so they are part of the ecosystem. And actually, one thing about miners, and this probably could persist for a while, and this kind of actually stabilizes it, is that going into a competitive industry is actually like a horrible idea. Like if you're an entrepreneur, a businessman, like if you have a great family pizza recipe, you don't want to be like, I'm going to go start a pizza by the slice restaurant in Brooklyn. Like this is like it's just not a bright idea. Like you'd go start it somewhere else, build up, you know. There's actually I watched this great talk recently by Peter Thiel, who's maybe not your favorite, you know, everybody in the audience favorite person, but he says all the quiet parts loud. It's great. It's called Competition is for Losers. It's a great talk. He gives it to I think a Stanford CS group, and he just explains the way to make money is to go find an industry where you can wipe out the competition and then suck up all the profits, right? The last thing you want to do if you're a smart business person is to go into an extremely competitive industry, because there's no way you're going to make a lot of profits, and if you screw up just a little bit, you're going to end up losing a ton of money. So this might be somewhere where Bitcoin is actually being helped, because the people that are running into the mining industry, they're actually there because they're somewhat supportive of Bitcoin. They're not just trying to make a quick buck, because you can't really make a quick buck. And historically, from everything I've heard, Bitcoin miners usually lose money in Bitcoin terms. They've made a lot of profits over the years because they've been on the good end of a bull market, but they've actually lost money. Like if they had, instead of invested in Bitcoin equipment, they would be buying Bitcoin. They would have been a much more successful business. So there is a lot of pro-Bitcoin ideology, and I think they are not really willing to go and do these things. They're not to cannibalizing each other yet. Like I think there's a point in the future where they could start to look at each other and say, okay, if we don't collude and start selfish mining or something, then, you know, this other group over here is going to do it, and then our profits are going to go to zero. We're going to have to sell all our equipment and go bankrupt. And I don't think we're there yet, but this could happen if we don't get another huge bull run. I mean, we've still had, you know, cycle to cycle, it's gone up by a multiple. if we go a cycle where it doesn't go up by a multiple, like if we don't breach 60,000 in 2025, things could get kind of testy with, because they can't just rely on sitting around and waiting for the bull market to make sure that they're all rich.
Well, and I mean, we saw that already kind of a little bit, I think, with Core Scientific, right? They overlevered against their machines going into the, like, during the last bull run, didn't sell when it was, like, peaking and were still holding too much when the market crashed and, like, ended up in bankruptcy because of it, is, I think, the broad strokes of their bankruptcy. I haven't covered it much specifically, so go read coverage before you take that as, like, a detailed series of events. But broadly, I think we've seen miners, like, throughout the history of Bitcoin mining end up in that kind of position because it's capital intensive to get started. You have ongoing costs. Your returns are delayed at least until you can get set up and the machines running. And like you mentioned, because, like, the market for Bitcoin mining is global and is global, you're competing with whoever has the lowest possible energy costs. And so if you don't have the lowest possible energy costs, you better hope that Bitcoin increases in dollar terms.
Yeah, this could happen. This is something where this could happen to the entire mining industry at some point. If there's a kind of nasty, you know, trip down during a bear market, this could be really nasty, especially with the hash market, with the hash rates going up. Like, I looked at it yesterday, it was like 370 million terahashes per second or something. This is really big, like, and, you know, relative to the price. We're about a year away from a halving, so, like, the price the profit margins are going to be really tiny coming up.
Yeah, especially around the halving. But I think a lot of the recent increase in hash rate is probably due to Bitmain filling some of the back orders they've had for their most recent machine, right? Because they had long back orders during the bull market and are finally filling some of those out. So we're seeing the efficiency of miners go up. So, like, in terms of hashes per dollar have gone up.
Yes.
Micah, would you like to explain what selfish mining is and how it changes the commonly accepted 51% number that Bitcoiners keep in their head?
Sure. Yes, I'd love to. So it's selfish mining. It's something which, it was, there was a paper that came up like 2013. Someone described this. If a miner...
It was Amin Gansur.
Yes.
Sirus, and, Amin Gansur of Avalanche, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes.
Well, he wasn't of Avalanche then.
But. Right. If a miner is to keep certain blocks secret, or mine a block, keep them secret, and then publish them at the right time, there's a process where, you know, they can, by publishing these at the right time, they can actually destroy more blocks of their competitors proportionally than they are losing of their own by risking them, by keeping them secret. And so, you know, it's, the math is like a Markov chain, and you can figure this out. It's kind of a polynomial divided by a polynomial. But you look at this function, and it shows you that once you get to 1/3 of the hash rate, you by increasing your hash rate a little bit and doing the selfish mining, you get more proportionally of the blocks in return. So this kind of abuses the difficulty adjustment a little bit. So this means that once someone starts selfish mining at 33%, they can start to bring in other miners, and it's always going to be a profitable investment to take hash away from the honest mining pool over to the selfish mining pool, because you're getting more, you know, it's just arbitrage opportunity, more bang for your buck by moving over to the selfish mining pool. And so this creates a situation where things could snowball, where, you know, one day it's 33%, next day it's 34, 35, 36, and then pretty soon you have a 51% attack, and then you're just monopoly mining. So this is one of those things where it's interesting when you consider this market fragility hypothesis and say, okay, what if a corporation just decided to start doing this, like, tomorrow? Would everybody just kind of, is that the moment they would like run away and go, you know, buy U.S. treasuries? Or, like, would we have to get to like 40% of the mining before they did that? Or what if they had 45% and were controlling most of the mining? And what if they just actually had like full control of the mining, but they promised to like stay true to Bitcoin's core principles and they weren't going to censor anybody, because that's, you know, and this was all good because now they can kind of ease down the hash rate, and we, you don't have to worry about the environmentalist FUD anymore. There's a lot of on ramps for this centralization. And I think selfish mining is one of the easiest ones because you just start at this level and you know, you can see it happening at first, but it can snowball. And if nobody freaks out and leaves, like everybody says is going to happen, you can try it. I mean, you could just start selfish mining and then nobody, you know, the price doesn't go down. Well, you just keep doing it. And this can work its way up to a full centralization attack.
Well, and I think what you pointed out there is like your only real other option in an attack like that is to leave and go somewhere else, to change the consensus algorithm and convince most of the Bitcoin community that now this coin is the new Bitcoin. And we all agree on that, so it's true. But that's like, and like that layer zero, that social consensus is fundamentally what drives a lot of this. And like, I think what you pointed out, where at what point do you decide we need to leave and like change this because it's a pressing concern, is kind of what makes this challenging. Because perhaps some folks, as soon as they see someone get to like 30%, are going to be like, this is a serious issue, we need to take steps. But if they can't convince enough of that mass, if enough stays in like the primary one, it can kind of trundle along to that point. And like, yeah, and so largely I think that's what it kind of comes down to with a lot of these types of attacks, and why like the Bitcoin culture's interaction with these ends up fascinating to me, because there is a portion of Bitcoin culture that treats the protocol itself as some like sacred thing with so many features that are never to be changed, that to even talk about changing them is like committing some type of heresy against Bitcoin. And there are some of these situations we're talking about where you end up in like this selfish mining attack where you need to decide which part is most sacred. Is it like staying on this historically longest chain that has followed this algorithm that everyone knew, described and handed out to everyone? Or is it changing that and preserving some other more vague aspect of Bitcoin that's important to you? It's censorship resistance, the distribution of its mining or whatever. And what's especially interesting to me is there have been many attempts throughout Bitcoin's history to like, there was at one point, I think even Luke Dash Jr. suggested adopting like Monero's ASIC resistance, where they hop between different algorithms at some randomly determined pace, and that would help decentralize Bitcoin mining and prevent it from like centralizing into ASICs. There have been other people who have suggested like switching Bitcoin to like wholly different consensus algorithms that use like, there was one that wanted to use like lasers reading disks or something that got some brief support. But like none of these have ever been able to get like anything approaching what I would call serious consideration in the Bitcoin community. And I think that kind of highlights how insidious this type of attack, or how effective this type of attack could be, because it's really hard to build that type of consensus in the Bitcoin community.
And I guess obviously any, you know, effect to counter this by going to a new algorithm, how long is it going to take for that new algorithm to be, you know, swamped by the same forces, or completely new ones, right? I mean, and I guess if you're thinking a little bit more cynically, how do we know that like Luke Dasher doesn't have already talked to some people who have built this thing and it's ready to go? I mean, we can trust him and maybe he's not out to do that, but what if, you know, we're not supposed to trust him? Maybe he's already had some of these machines ready to go, and next thing you know, he's going to have, he's going to do selfish mining on these laser discs or whatever, or, you know.
I don't think he was related to that weird optical. Like spinning disc consensus algorithm. But I'm pretty sure he did at one point want to adopt like the Monero for a while had one where they switched between like a random set of algorithms at random times in the hopes that it would never be worthwhile for someone to accumulate like enough of the different ASICs to cover that. But like Monero is also far smaller than Bitcoin and the rewards are far smaller. And so the incentives end up a little bit different. Like there's less people willing to develop custom chips for a smaller market.
I haven't looked at that algorithm, but in general, when you combine things, you get a nonlinear relationship between like input and output, or like input and like how many blocks you get. And the nonlinear is really bad for centralization. The nice thing about like Nakamoto consensus is if you're contributing 15% of the hash rate, you expect to get 15% of the block rewards. But if it's nonlinear, like there's all sorts of incentives for centralization.
That was back in middle of 2018 that I remember Monero having a bunch of issues running these ASICs and trying a bunch of different things. For a while, they were just like regularly hard forking to new algorithms with like a month's notice or something like that. But then I thought they'd change it to something else where it switched between several. But it doesn't particularly matter. The important point here is, like, it's hard to get consensus for that kind of thing. And, like, it's hard to get consensus to change the Bitcoin supply cap. They tried to get consensus to change the Bitcoin block size. They got many of the most important, like, companies and people in the Bitcoin ecosystem together at consensus and had them all sign a piece of paper. And still that ended up not being enough consensus for Bitcoin to actually change those things. And so, like, I think that, like, escape to that layer zero, social escape, ends up really challenging in a culture like Bitcoin's.
Yeah, and that the block size war is interesting in that I think people have tried to glean a lot of, like, you know, universal wisdoms from this, and that, like, you know, maybe it's true you can't change it. Maybe smaller blocks are better. Maybe the miners are always the bad guys or will always lose and the nodes always win. But this is one of the, like, it's sort of built into the whole mythology of Bitcoin now that the nodes are always going to have the final say. And I don't really know precisely. I tried to, like, figure out what exactly precisely that means and how that would make sense. But it's kind of part of the understanding now is that the nodes would be able to soft fork away anything that they didn't like. And I don't actually believe this. This is something which I think requires a lot more of an argument than, what about 2017? So if this happened again in the future, it happened 20 years in the future, and the miners said, no, listen, we're going with this hard fork. These are, you know, 20, you know, the ninth halving or whatever will be the last. There's no more halvings after that. That's our hard fork. You know, get on board. It's not clear that the same, you know, it's we're you know, relitigating the block war again. It's like the block size war. It's like whatever's going on in the world in 2041 or whatever. It's completely different situation, completely different dynamics. And if Bitcoin is a thing which people are using every day and they need to rely on it, then they don't want to challenge miners who have, you know, will at this point be working with all these major financial corporations to you know, set up Lightning channels for, you know, Wells Fargo and all that kind of stuff. They're all going to go with the miners, right? They're not going to, like, let their nodes fight and cause a soft fork, which is going to destroy the world's financial system when everything's on Bitcoin. So I think these dynamics become completely flipped once we get to this magical place where Bitcoin is, like, you know, indispensable and adopted by everybody.
I think there's lots of assumptions that were made around 2017, which over the coming decades people will find were not true. Thank you very much for joining us today, Micah. Anyone who wants can check out his recent textbook, Bitcoin, A Game Theoretic Analysis, which has more detailed information about different attacks, Bitcoin security, how to think about it, how to model it, and, like, really how to understand these different things.
I should warn it.
Thank you very much for joining us.
I should warn it's a little bit mathy.
Like that, yeah, it's a math textbook. It's a graduate level math textbook, to be clear. So if you're interested in a graduate level math textbook about the game theory of Bitcoin, it's the best. It dominates that category.
Yes. Competition is for losers.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.